what was the only cradle of culture in the world in the 8th century, while the English were still either in crise or beating each other about the head, until the French brought them a tincture of culture. In contrast with the intractable Mr. Shenfield, my next speaker obliged me with a timely vitae, of which I unfortunately, due to the inordinate amount of time that Arthur took, I can only sketch briefly for you. Dwight Murphy has his Juris Doctor degree from the University of Denver College of Law, which he received magna cum laude. He is also a Bachelor of the Science of Law, University of Denver, attended the Graduate School of Business Administration at New York University, and studied political science at Colorado University. In addition, he is a member of Phi Beta Kappa. He has taught, is teaching now, but he has also practiced law, thus giving the lie to the old maxim of practicing lawyers that those who can do and those who can't teach. And so it is with great pleasure and the knowledge that the Irish will not be defamed that I give you my next speaker, Professor Dwight Murphy.
Well, after those splendid speakers this morning and then what I anticipated Arthur was going to say, thought I was really in a bind. But now that he's gone ahead and shot it for both of us, insulting both of us up here, that I think I'm really freed up. I'm able to relax now and go ahead and read you my talk, which I did dutifully prepare, and it times out at 29 minutes, so I think we'll be all right. The political climate in the United States today is constructive far beyond what most conservatives during our lifetimes have ever dared to hope for. This Reagan Revolution, and yeah, I hope it's all right to call it that here, allows us to consider intellectual and practical questions which just a few short months ago seemed hopelessly remote from anything that was politically thinkable. Most directly and obviously, this change has been the result of the election of Ronald Reagan and of the splendid leadership he's giving. Those who wish to understand social causation will want to remember that there was a time, however, when the American people seemed far indeed from ever electing anyone like him. There have been profound changes in our society and in our intellectual culture that have made his leadership possible. Because of these changes, far-reaching political and philosophical options have been opened for us to consider. No doubt constitutional law is just one of several important dimensions of those issues. But it speaks well for the conservatives' respect for law that at the first opportunity following President Reagan's election, those who arrange the programs of the Philadelphia Society have seen fit to make the Constitution a focus of the national meeting. Both the theorists of a free society and the more thoughtful jurists of the American legal system are now called upon to analyze and to decide the difficult questions that are involved in determining just where it is that America's new beginning should take our Constitution. During the past half century, the Constitution has been carried far from its original moorings. Prior to that time, this great charter was seen not only as an instrument of grant, bestowing powers upon the national government, but also as one of delimitation. The Constitution was interpreted with a conscious awareness that the genius of our system is decentralization, and that it's essential to such a political system to keep the states truly viable. There was also a reverential awareness that the Constitution was a charter protecting individual liberty. It was a heresy to suggest that the Constitution was an empty vessel into which anything could be poured, including an all-embracing statism. There were the specific liberties listed in the first 8 amendments, and there was the reservoir of unspoken liberty that James Madison so wisely reminded us of in the 9th. The Supreme Court construed this liberty in the context of the values of a liberal society in the classical sense of the word liberal. High among these liberties was the freedom to contract. Economic freedom was as important a constitutional value as were the freedoms of speech, religion, press, and assembly. The dismal dichotomy between human rights and property rights had not yet so fully won the day in the intellectual world. Arthur told me he was going to mention certain pestiferous doctrines, and I'm surprised he didn't mention that one. Now that we as a nation have for so long been led away from these moorings, but seem markedly to be returning to the values that underlay them, difficult and unique questions of legal philosophy confront us. It's essential that conservative intellectuals begin to think through how we ought to approach the fundamental choices that the new situation places before us. Are we to confirm the Constitution as its interpretation now stands? Or are we consciously to seek ways to steer the Constitution toward a renewed foundation on truly liberal values? The first of these alternatives involves accepting the interpretive products of the constitutional revolution, which occurred during and after the New Deal. It would have us acknowledge as valid the vast increase that has occurred in the power of government in general, and of the federal government in particular. Most conservatives will almost certainly view such a ratification of the recent constitutional zeitgeist with dismay. Nevertheless, this course offers some enticing advantages. It allows us to adhere to some important values in our traditional legal philosophy. We haven't wanted the Constitution to be a floating document, taking the shape at any given time of whatever the judges say it is. If conservative legal philosophy were now to urge the Supreme Court to clear no major new pathways, it would become a relatively easy matter for the future court to elevate the principle of stare decisis to a place of honor. Judicial restraint would be the hallmark. After the adventurism of the courts during the war years, this is a welcome relief. It isn't too much to say that it was precisely such relief that President Nixon sought when he appointed Justices Berger, Blackmun, Powell, and Rehnquist to the court. The country has gained immensely from the non-agitational jurisprudence brought about by these appointments. But conservatives should be aware that there is no sense of mission among those more conservative justices about where, if anywhere, they should take the Constitution. The second of the alternatives is fundamentally a radical one, at least in the best sense of that word, as suggesting a concern for principles. It involves a deliberate course of reconstituting the Constitution. I can't emphasize too much that this will require an enormous amount of wisdom and statecraft on the part of the justices who attempt it. Hopefully, they won't have to do it alone, but will act within a general resurgence of sound intellectual values that will give them inspiration and guidance. I think the point should also be made, although I think this is debatable, we've been looking backward a lot here, but I think, nevertheless, the point should be made that it's neither possible nor desirable, literally, to go back to an earlier time in the history of the Constitution and try to pick up from there. We don't want to engage in silly cliches, but it isn't far off the mark to say that we'll need to go forward, not backward, into a creative regeneration of the Constitution as a delimiting document. The disadvantage of this second alternative will, of course, be that the period of transition will quite visibly entail a pronounced judicial activism in a conservative direction. We would leave the precedents alone, where they would reflect a mature appreciation of modern conditions, but we would consciously disregard stare decisis, where we would think that the precedents have been informed by the warpings of the modern liberal worldview. We can well suppose that the Alpheus Masons and Arthur Schlesinger Juniors of the world will take respite from their pain by pointing out with much delight the irony of our having embraced an activism of our own. But to me, that isn't all that much a drawback. We conservatives should appreciate by now that whenever there's a new wave of the future, some little pleasure ought to be left for those who remain in the backwaters. I'm going to want to discuss these alternatives some more and to tell you why I prefer the latter, but it's going to be awfully hard to do that unless we first clear away some of the slogans and superficialities that in the modern discussion of constitutional law obscure an appropriate understanding of the Supreme Court and its role. Any student of the subject hears a lot about such things as strict versus broad construction, the flexibility of a living constitution versus the dead hand of mechanistic jurisprudence. majority rule versus dull-headed reaction, social engineering versus a purely reflexive stare decisis, and judicial restraint versus judicial activism. In point of fact, much of this is nonsense. Or if that's too strong, at least we can say that it's all exceedingly unhelpful. These concepts suffer from two major flaws. In the first place, they're ad hoc concepts that aren't intended to fit coherently into any larger conceptual scheme about politics and society. And this severely restricts their intellectual usefulness. In the second place, those who repeat them fail to see that most of them have come into being as labels and slogans that have served as specific tactical ploys at different junctures in the past during the development of modern liberal political ideology. They virtually all state dichotomies that have been serviceable to modern liberalism at one time or another during its struggle for intellectual ascendancy. There's no reason for conservatism to make them a part of its own analysis once their origins are clearly understood. The distinction between broad construction and strict construction is the oldest of these dichotomies, and for that reason it escapes some of the taint deserved by the others, since it's not itself a part of the semantic of modern liberalism. Just the same, however, it's widely misunderstood. The thing to notice is that neither broad nor strict construction, when applied to an instrument like a will, a lease, a deed, a contract, or a power of attorney, is always and exclusively the best method for construing the document. Sometimes the court will see that the draftsman wrote in fine detail, making hairline distinctions and exploring all possibilities with great care. And one would hope that he would do that on a will or something of that nature. A judge construing such an instrument will need to give a narrow construction to the words, since each was used with a carefully drawn denotation. There are other documents, though, in which the draftsman is painted with a broad brush, speaking in generalities. Here, a broad construction will best clean out the intention. In neither case does the judge acting properly seek to substitute his own preference for the intention of the draftsman. The type of construction is adopted precisely to determine what that intention was in light of the nature of the document itself. There are times in the law when public policy dictates the method of interpretation. Criminal statutes are typically given a narrow construction, protective statutes a broad one. There's an important rule that where there's leeway, language is to be construed most favorably to the party who didn't draft it or provide the form. When in the early years of American history, there was the debate over the strict versus the broad construction of the Constitution, this distinction between methods of interpretation served as a legal facade for what was actually an argument between the Hamiltonian and Jeffersonian political philosophies. It wasn't primarily an argument over legal method. It was a debate over the size and influence of the national government. To some degree, there was a sincere difference over what the Philadelphia Convention had intended, but it's not surprising that each side understood that intention to have been in line with what it already thought was proper about the role of the government in Washington. For the purposes of our analysis today, however, this debate is hardly important in itself. What is important is that we notice that the later modern liberal advocacy of flexibility and a living document bears no true resemblance to either of these older schools, including even the Hamiltonian school that favored broad construction. It was, after all, the Constitution that even the broad constructionists were interpreting. They never came up with a doctrine to justify simply free-floating the content of the Constitution. When Chief Justice John Marshall handed down the original package doctrine as an interpretation of the Interstate Commerce Clause, he included in commerce the entire process of shipment from packaging to unpackaging. This holding was certainly a broad construction compared to the position of those who argued that interstate commerce occurs only at the instant that goods are actually passing over a state line. We should notice, though, that Marshall's doctrine was quite delimiting compared to the doctrine that was eventually promulgated by the New Deal Court in the late 1930s and early 40s. The New Deal court's holding, in effect, transferred all productive processes, even though preliminary to packaging for shipment, to the federal government's jurisdiction. This was a shift of virtually the entire economic system. Those who justified this on the basis that the Constitution is a living document couldn't relate the holding to the precedents of the preceding century and a half, or to the intention of the framers acting in Philadelphia. But they had ceased to care about doing that. In fact, the modern liberal legal philosophers have argued during the 20th century that the Constitution is not to be considered fundamentally a classical liberal document. They've charged, in the words of their patron, St. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., that any attempt to consider it such is an attempt to enshrine Herbert Spencer's social statics. These writers go so far as to charge the earlier justices with having been judicial activists in their own right when they struck down social democratic legislation in the name of a classically liberal constitution. What we need to realize is that functionally, the Constitution stood as a major obstacle to the policies favored by modern liberalism. There were two ways that this obstacle could be overcome. One was by amendment, and this actually was accomplished in those few democratizing instances where a national consensus could be formed for an amendment, such as for the direct election of senators or the right of women to vote. The other way, which was necessary for the many changes that could not generate enough support for a formal amendment, I imagine that entire shift of economic power from the states to the federal government was certainly one of those, was by securing the intellectual ascendancy of a relativistic view of law and of the Constitution. Mr. Justice Holmes argued that law should not be defined as the body of rules coming down from the volumes in a law library. He said, law is nothing more or less than a prediction of what a judge will do in fact. This change in focus from established norms to immediate action reflected the classic confrontation between a system of law and a system of men. If by this change to a system of men, the Constitution could become whatever the judges say it is, modern liberalism, once it attained a majority on the court, would be free of the delimitations of a classical liberal constitution. Let me say that there's no use gnashing our teeth over the Constitution's seeming weakness in having been unable by its own intrinsic nature to have avoided being carried away in this manner. A constitution is a blueprint for institutions and is a legal, social, political, and moral document. If the predominant intellectual culture of an age has long since changed, there's no way that a constitution can permanently override the sophistries and rationalizations by which that new intellectual culture will seek to remold it. It wasn't really the New Deal that washed away the classical liberal constitution. It was our loss in the intellectual battles of the Western world. What happened to the Constitution was simply the culmination of the changes that had been going on for a century. That's why this is something of a brave speech here today. I'm going to be talking about what great things we can do with the Constitution before I'm fully convinced that the intellectual direction of our society is permanently changed. Only the unfolding of history can assure us of that. And I was glad to hear Senator East's comments to that effect today, that we're not sure. We're very full of hope, but we aren't sure. If we wind up losing the struggle from the minds of the predominant intellectual culture and of the public at large, we're not going to accomplish any major constitutional objectives in the long run. Even President Reagan's administration will only be a rest stop on our society's long march to the beat of a different drummer. There have been some intricacies involved in the modern liberals' positions about the Constitution in the 20th century. There's been more to it than their having simply affirmed constitutional relativism. Modern liberalism is a social democratic ideology that brings together the intellectuals, and I probably ought to say the alienated intellectuals, with all disaffected and unassimilated elements in a society. As such, it's been ambivalent toward majority rule. So long as the presidency was occupied by a conservative, and American courts held out for a delimiting constitution, The hue and cry among modern liberals in the earliest 20th century called for letting the local majorities experiment. That was a very popular position with the liberal justices. But later, a more successful modern liberalism showed its underlying elitism. The Warren Court became an elitist avant-garde for democracy, articulating the intellectuals' conception about what form democracy should take, and often riding roughshod over some very substantial actual majorities to do it. I'm thinking particularly of the ruling a few years ago against Proposition 14 in California, which had been passed by a 2-to-1 majority, and of the cases that struck down statewide referenda that sought to avoid implementing a pure one-man, one-vote dogma in state senates. All during the years that modern liberalism was on the outside looking in, gaining an electoral victory here and a victory there, yet another part of the modern liberal hue and cry was that any court that would strike down social democratic legislation was being activist. This was the fervent complaint against the Supreme Court, too, during the early years of the New Deal, when even after Roosevelt's election, a majority of the justices remained true to a delimiting view of the Constitution. When these justices struck down the NRA and some other New Deal legislation, they were denounced as activists and usurpers. This is the key to understanding the later division within modern liberalism itself between the proponents of judicial activism and judicial restraint. An entire generation of modern liberal jurists, such as Felix Frankfurter, this is the earlier generation, had devoted their careers to denouncing what they thought was the activism of a classical liberal judiciary. They urged the court to cease and desist from all such intervention into the affairs of the executive and legislative branches and of the states. During the years they so vehemently supported this view, their position was in line with the tactical needs of modern liberal social policy, since it argued for taking the leash off of social legislation. The situation changed, however, when at last modern liberalism had elected some presidents and had filled the Supreme Court entirely with its own kind. Now it was the Congress and the states who were recalcitrant, not the Supreme Court. It speaks well for the ultimate integrity of such a justice as Felix Frankfurter that he never understood his lifetime's position to have been just a stage in a tactical situation. He kept right on fighting for judicial restraint during the closing years of his career. But the newer justices of the modern liberal faith had not become so imbued with the arguments born out of that earlier necessity. These newer justices saw no reason to hold the Supreme Court in check now that it was on the side of the forces of good. The Warren Court was the result. This, it seems to me, is a helpful and accurate analysis of what occurred, but I don't want to overstate it. The Warren Court was certainly radical in its judicial method, and it made some surprising changes, such as when it held that the principle that underlay the Connecticut Compromise couldn't be applied to state senate. But if the left were to charge it with having, in general, shown the timidity that has been typical of modern liberalism as the American version of social democratic ideology, there would be ample justification for the charge. The Warren Court by no means did all that an activist modern liberal court could have done, despite its reputation among conservatives to the contrary. Take just one important example. Under the concurrent powers doctrine, the states are totally excluded from any area of interstate commerce as to which the Supreme Court believes that there should be a uniform national rule. Of course, another way to exclude the states is by congressional preemption of an area. But there's another side to that. That's if the U.S. Supreme Court holds that there has to be a uniform national rule on something. A series of Warren Court decisions declaring the need for uniformity in major areas could have destroyed the states totally. But the Warren Court didn't do it, and so far as I know, modern liberal legal activists didn't even ask that it be done. When Richard Nixon sought to turn the tide of judicial activism as manifested in its own peculiar way by the Warren Court, he appointed four justices who embraced the philosophy of judicial restraint. These four have been separate individuals, of course, with varying degrees of conservatism and differing senses of their historic mission. Until the change in national mood that was expressed in the election of Ronald Reagan, however, these justices, still in a fringe situation so far as dominance on the court is concerned, have been in no position to even consider a more activist effort, if we may call it that, to exercise the statecraft that would be needed to breathe a renewed classical liberal spirit back into the Constitution. Warren Burger, in fact, has made so mundane a subject as judicial administration the focus of his tenure as Chief Justice. This is a worthy objective, to be sure, but it's a side issue so far as the philosophy of government and of society is concerned. I'd hope that as new Reagan appointees take their place on the court, they'll be able to meld well with those who are already there, and that together they'll be able to see that today is significantly different than yesterday, with new opportunities and vision. I've yet to tell you why I favor the more activist of the alternatives we face. We should, in the near future, discuss these choices vigorously. I imagine we'll do that as soon as I get through time. And neither should be taken for granted. Here are some of the thoughts I have on which way a conservative court should go. First, if a conservative majority on the court impresses the validating stamp of stare decisis onto everything that the modern liberal court did during the past half century, it will thereby consolidate with one stroke the products of a legal philosophy which has rationalized without the slightest shame a course of judicial usurpation. This will mean that conservatism will be engaging in the traditionalist's worst vice, will have let others lead the way in the pursuit of their own ideology, secure in the anticipation that we would serve only as an inconvenient drag, and that we would eventually legitimize everything that they've done because of our own unwillingness to unsettle anything. Second, there are a number of things which are just plain wrong about the Constitution as now interpreted, at least if we view the Constitution as we should, as a classical liberal document of both grant and delimitation. In countless ways, the unbalanced half-perceptions that make up the modern liberal view of the world have become the informing principles of our national charter. I personally see no moral or legal justification for feeling guilty about setting these things right. Third, a so-called activist course need not be a reckless one. In fact, I very much hope that it wouldn't be. It need not go at breakneck speed, but can be articulated by degrees as the necessary cases arise. That is the nature of court action anyway. Fourth, President Reagan has already appointed a commission to study the appropriate line of demarcation between the federal government and the states. The findings of that commission can either help guide a conservative majority on the court or serve as the basis for a constitutional amendment which will relieve the court of the job of redefining the line. It would be a shame to clutter the Constitution with extensive amendments to put things right, but in pivotal areas, that may be the best course. I'd like to see it unequivocally stated that the state, not the national government, are to have primary jurisdiction over education and police work, for example, while the fact that we have an enormous common market in the United States suggests that there are areas relating to commerce in which the national government is a better source of law than 50 states would be. Fifth, we would want to start by anticipating that the day would come when we would declare the transition finished, so that thereafter stare decisis could fully apply. I'm among those who would certainly welcome this, since I personally don't like the idea of judges making law. Article 5 of the Constitution sets out the procedure for amending the Constitution, and I'd like to see the day come when that's acknowledged as the exclusive method for amending the Constitution. Sixth, the constraints that a classical liberal rebirth ought to place on government should not, in my opinion, be those that would be envisioned by the Night Watchman school of classical liberal thought. The government of a free society has much more to do than just to be a night watchman acting against force and fraud. The statecraft that is needed in reviving constitutionalism should be cognizant of the fact that the opponents of social democracy, which is what we are, have been fighting a holding action for so long that many of their concepts are handicapped by the doctrinaire narrowness that comes from being too long on the defensive. Those of us who hold to a classical liberal view of society must expand our awareness that there are many things that government does that are in service of the market, establishing the preconditions legally and institutionally for a satisfactory market system. There are other things that government does, such as the space program, that require more organization and funding than private enterprise can provide. Every conservative will want the market economy to be the cornerstone of freedom in our society. And I'd have the Supreme Court serve as a far more jealous guardian of that primacy. But this doesn't mean nearly so radical a reduction of the powers of government as the night watchman school calls for, or as the opponents of an intelligent conservatism might fear. Looking further, there is hardly an aspect of our society that can't be improved if the reforming spirit of original liberalism is reawakened. There's no reason for a conservative court to stand in the way of the legislation that reform would entail. We're at a juncture in history that calls for much fresh thinking. We need a theory for a truly rounded and adequate free society. I would hope that we would be able to work together intellectually with the neoconservatives who've been recently coming in our direction from the left and who've now gained an appreciation for the value of the market and for the delimitation of governmental power. They can perhaps have much to tell us about how we might, consistently with our own values, address the many human problems which, in our defensiveness, we found it necessary to exclude from our theory. Some of these observations, or particularly in more recent ones, are bound to be provocative even to members of the Philadelphia Society. Others will no doubt be provocative to people who are not conservatives. But it's not properly an objection to that what I'm saying is provocative. What we need right now is a vibrant intellectual movement involving much discussion, since there's a great deal that is unsettled about the content of modern conservatism. Now that the country is beginning to look to us for leadership, we must respond with a conception of government and of society that is fully adequate to all the needs of modern civilization. If we're successful, the Supreme Court of the United States will inevitably play a role both in helping to formulate the necessary theory and in giving voice to that which a new conservative intellectual culture can provide. We've just begun, really, on an intellectual quest of great fascination and importance.